Welcome to, well, not another episode, but part two of the Venezuela and Guyana Border Chronicles on Tenement Yard's political podcast, Checkmate. I'm Clifford, your host for this episode. As stated in part one, in this recording, we will cover the now of the border dispute, the effects of big oil, imperialism, and touch on CARICOM's role in all this. For those who are just listening, I'll encourage you to listen to part one first so you have the historical context of it all. But if that's how your brain works, you can just start here. With no further ado, here to discuss this is Dr. Tamanisha J. John, assistant professor in the Department of Politics at York University, a specialist in Caribbean development, sovereignty, and politics, as well as a Canadian foreign policy, economic imperialism, and financial exclusion specialist. Dr. John, welcome to the yard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, just to get right into it. All right. So in numerous discussions on this issue, oil has played a major role, right, in this whole talking point. For those unfamiliar, could you provide a quick overview of the history of oil in Venezuela and the potential impact on Guyana?
Yes. And so since the early 1900s, and especially during the 1930s, we saw that Venezuela, which was independent at this time since the 1830s, started to expand and benefit on oil and petroleum that it found in its delineated territory. And so even though Venezuela was expanding in its oil and petroleum industries, it wasn't that Venezuela was doing it. It's that foreign exploitation of this industry happened in Venezuela quite early on. And so there's laws actually in Venezuela that date back to the 1930s that aim to limit foreign bosses controlling Venezuelan workers in the oil industry. And so Venezuela has found oil in the early 1900s, starts exploiting it massively in the 1930s, but a lot of this oil exploration and processing is done by foreign corporations. And because of that, within the country itself, you had massive wealth gaps that existed with limited development. And this influence of oil in Venezuela undoubtedly influenced the later revolution and the changed relationship the Venezuelan state would have with oil under Chavez when he gets the power. By the early 1970s, 30% of U.S. oil imports, for instance, came from Venezuela. And during the OPEC crisis of states in Latin America and the Caribbean, Venezuela had a favorable balance of payments outcome because of this relationship that it had to the U.S. And so unlike other states in Latin America and the Caribbean that also had oil, Venezuela's oil was more positive for its economy, given that its imports didn't drown out oil earnings like you saw in countries like Trinidad, for instance. And so even though this is Venezuela's economic situation, oil did not benefit regular Venezuelans who saw the cost of living increase in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And it also didn't help any sort of broader developments in Venezuela. And so by the late 1970s, more oil continued to be found in Venezuela, but it was being exploited by foreign corporations that didn't pay attention to actually developing or helping regular Venezuelans. So how does this impact Guyana as it is trying to get rid of colonialism and achieve independence in the late 60s? Well, since Guyanese independence leaders were socialist or communist, both Venezuela and the U.S. perceived Guyana gaining independence under a socialist or communist leader as a threat to Venezuela and also to U.S. oil imports that it was acquiring from Venezuela. And so the U.S. saw Guyana as posing a threat to its oil interests and to the broader ideological leanings in the region, because, again, you had the Cold War going on. And so at the eve of Guyana's independence, Venezuela claimed that Guyana was arming revolutionaries in Venezuela, struggling against the Venezuelan regime, which was aligned with U.S. imperialism. And so oil has always played a prominent factor in sort of any tensions that first initially brewed between Venezuela and Guyana.
Oh, okay. All right. So like, okay. In the previous episode, we're talking to Professor Jacqueline Brayboy-Wagner, and she was saying that the United States, they didn't necessarily change their position. So how can I put this? So when the right-wing government was, I guess, in charge in Venezuela. They were backing them on the border. Well, she didn't say they were backing them on the border issue, my apologies. She said that they didn't really take a stance on the border issue. But now they're taking a stance on the Guyana side, since, you know, the whole change in governments and all. Would you agree with that?
So I would say previously and historically, since Venezuela went to the United States and lobbied them to use the Monroe Doctrine and force Britain into arbitration, when Venezuela started making its border claims, the U.S. sort of took a neutral position, because if the U.S. agreed with Venezuela, then the U.S. would in some instance be undermining its own first type of foreign policy strength in the region, because one of its first foreign policy goals was aligning with Venezuela to get this border arbitrated. And technically, the U.S. saw that the border arbitration worked not just in Britain's favor, but also in Venezuela's favor. So to then back Venezuela at this point, it would be like the U.S. going back and saying, well, wait, the arbitration that we made happen didn't really work. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have the U.S. at that time trying to admit that they were making these massive foreign policy mistakes. In fact, U.S. political leaders at the time viewed them bringing the British to arbitration and the British being frightened of potential war with the U.S. if they didn't go to arbitration as a win. And so it is not surprising that the U.S. didn't forcefully recognize Venezuela, then trying to say, well, wait a minute, the arbitration was bad, because the arbitration, again, was mediated by the United States in many respects. And today, when you see the U.S. taking a more forceful stance, saying that it will back Guyana, it is 100% related to the fact that U.S. and Southcom has been very aggressive, especially in the last 3 to 4 years, towards Venezuela, mm-hmm. and also towards, you know, getting China out of the region. And so it is not that the U.S. is backing Guyana on the border. In fact, the U.S. hasn't made any statement saying that the Guyanese border or Guyana's territory is already settled and it is as is. The U.S. has just been making security overtures, saying that they will help Guyana defend itself. But the U.S. still has not made any specific claim, even today, as it is saying it will lend Guyana military support, saying that the border is in dispute or that Guyana's borders are solidified. The U.S. is not saying that. The U.S. is just saying we will defend Guyana. And in turn, what they're really saying is they will defend their oil interests in Guyana.
Oh, okay. So thank you for that. On the point of like Southcom, which is U.S. Southcom, for those who don't know, since the appointment of General Laura Richardson in 2021, has been, you know, very overt in its desire, as you said, to capitalize off natural resources and to kick China out of the region. Have you observed any responses from like Venezuela and other like leftist states in the region following her overtures?
So yes, I was actually quite critical of General Laura Richardson being appointed to Southcom, especially since she's coming from a sort of Middle East context, where she was also a bit of a, I don't even know what they say it in the U.S., but a bit of a, is it a hawk, is when they call someone who has like a hawkish type of foreign policy lens or perspective. Yeah. And so since Richardson's appointment in the second half of 2021, so late October 2021, Richardson has made it clear that her priority is to view the Latin American and Caribbean region as a competitive space for the U.S. as it regards securing U.S. access to resources in the area. She has also shared that the major competitor she sees in the region is China-U.S. competition. And given the clarity in which Richardson has been making these goals about resources and resource competition in the region clear, and how blatant she has proclaimed this competition to be about security strategy and resources in the region, there's been a few times where representatives from even China have had to make it clear that China is engaged in mutual benefit and mutual respect partnerships aimed at common development in Central and South America and the Caribbean, and that China is not playing these sorts of strategic games wherein they have to grant where they have this grand geopolitical agenda in Latin America to gain influence. They even directly called out Richardson for suggesting that they do. So you had Liu Pengyu at the Chinese embassy to the United States responding to Richardson and Southcom's declaration, saying that people in the U.S. should take off their colored glasses, abandon the outdated Monroe Doctrine and Cold War mentality, and stop spreading disinformation about China stop coercing Latin American countries to choose sides and stop sowing discord between China and Latin America. Okay. And still, even though this is the case, Chinese infrastructural projects in the region, especially in the Caribbean, continue to be labeled as nefarious by Southcom. I don't know if you remember this, but they had the whole false claim that China was spying out of Cuba using balloons.
Yes, yes.
Or an even earlier claim wherein if Jamaica used China's help to get 5G, the Communist Party of China would then be allowed to spy on governments in the entire America's hemisphere. So if Jamaica accepted this deal, the U.S. would retaliate against Jamaica somehow. And so China has been viewed in that aggressive light. But even when you look at the region, Evo Morales had to tweet at General Laura Richardson and Southcom earlier this year to remind them that Latin America is not your backyard or your farm to exploit natural resources. Faced with the new Yankee interventionist threat, we reiterate that the free peoples of the Patria Grande will defend their sovereignty. And then, of course, outside of this, ever since Richardson became sort of the general leader of Southcom, her stated approach towards Venezuela has been extremely hostile. In fact, she spent the first few months as leader of Southcom claiming that Venezuela was harboring terrorists in the region, engaged in systematic mass drug trafficking in the region, and creating internal problems for Colombia. And so because of this, she claimed that Venezuela was a threat to regional security and that it had a humanitarian crisis. And it was using a massive amount of Russian arms against its population. And so given sort of Richardson and Southcom's aggressive propaganda as it regards Venezuela and also states like Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and she has six states that she claims are problem states in the region, but she was able to successfully make the case at U.S. Congress as to why there needs to be increased Southcom military exercises in the region. So when we talk about Venezuela and Southcom under Richardson, you're talking about the securitization and weaponization of propaganda by official U.S. security forces that have been aggressive in the region ever since Richardson became commander. And I think that highlighting the spreading of misinformation by Richardson and Southcom as it regards Venezuela is important because Southcom's propaganda and the consistent securitization of Venezuela is harboring terrorists. As engaged in systematic drug trafficking is suffering from humanitarian crisis that warrants more frequent Southcom exercises in the region because Venezuela is some ticking time bomb that poses a threat. It does warrant some apprehension by Venezuela. And this goes back to the piece that I wrote in my in the Black Agenda report, where I pointed out that Venezuela does have legitimate security concerns with Guyana's increased engagement with Southcom, especially since Richardson, who has been very clear that intervention must happen or regime change must happen in Venezuela. And even after Richardson became the leader in the post-2020 aftermath of Guyana's elections, where the incumbent PPP party was open to Western intervention via Pompeo to ensure that the transition of power happened in Guyana, it wasn't just that we will help the transition happen, but they also made it clear that they wanted the PPP or the former administration in Guyana to broadcast messages into Venezuela that would, rally up the people for intervention. And the previous administration said no. And I think that this administration also took the stance of no at that time as well. And so again, Richardson has been very hostile to Venezuela, has been very hostile to the region in general, has been very hostile to China. So there's been a lot of statements put out against a lot of what she has said, because how she speaks about it is that the U.S. somehow owns all of the resources in the region.
Gotcha. And I think also, correct me if I'm wrong, there was also talks of, in that very same congressional hearing, talks of possible base within Guyana to quote-unquote protect its resources or show it how to protect resources.
There was talks wherein she believed that she would have to convince the Guyanese government to get a military base to protect resources, again, because she securitizes Venezuela as some hostile neighbor towards Guyana.
Yeah.
But during the time where she had her meeting in March, it was more so we have to convince the Guyanese people of this, and not that it would happen. And so, again, there may have been some apprehension on the part of Guyana about having a U.S. base.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. No, Many have called Venezuela's actions as this sort of bully in the region. Some say it's an imperialistic thing, but you, on other platforms, have referred to Venezuela's actions as chauvinistic. Could you like elaborate on that talking point?
Yes, and so a lot of people have been mad that I've actually used the term chauvinistic, but I want to make it very clear that I opted for the word chauvinism instead of imperialism or colonial expansion, which is how many in the Guyanese left have described Venezuela's actions over the past month. I do not view Venezuela as an imperialist state or as a state engaged in colonial expansion, and so that is why I would not say that Venezuela is imperial or Venezuela is engaged in colonial expansion, but Venezuela is engaged in chauvinism. And how I settled on this term was not some random pick of the hat, but what I did was, because I understood Venezuela's security concerns, since I have been, you know, keeping up with Richardson's statements in the region ever since she, you know, became commander of SOUTCOM, but I instead tried to research why Guyanese Marxist-Leninists in the 70s opted not to call Venezuela an imperial lackey or a puppet of the U.S., even though they described Venezuela as a state that aligned with Western imperialisms in the region. And part of the reason why they chose the term chauvinist instead of imperialist or colonial expansion was because they recognized that the majority of Venezuelans were living in misery, and the border claim was to rally nationalism in Venezuela versus having direct confrontation with Guyana. And also they recognized that Venezuela opted for nationalism against Venezuelan revolutionaries, even though it increased tensions with Guyana, because the fact of oil in Venezuela brought about Venezuela's own difficulties with imperialism. And so these Guyanese Marxists understood that Venezuela's oil industry was captured by foreign interests. And in order to quiet down revolution and to distract from the misery of the people in Venezuela, they would heighten up nationalism. And so because of that, they didn't view this nationalism as forceful or as threatening to Guyana, but just in rhetoric, given Venezuela's own internal struggles with imperialism. And so, in other words, Guyanese Marxist-Leninists in the 70s saw the contradictions that existed in Venezuela and its hostile political regimes due to the external imperialisms on Venezuela versus Venezuelans. And for me, this was also a better way to describe the present situation, even as the ideological situation between Guyana and Venezuela has flipped. And so why is chauvinism a better term? So chauvinism is a better term to use to describe Maduro's statements and Venezuela's actions as they relate to the referendum versus imperialism or colonial expansion, because chauvinism is based on the exclusion of people, not because you fail to recognize that they exist as full humans like the more sort of liberal paternalisms would do, but precisely because you believe that they exist, but that you know what is best for them to move forward or to progress. And so you place yourself as superior to them. So Venezuela's disregard of Guyanese people is not because they fail to account for the fact that Guyanese and Essequibo exist. In fact, Venezuela claimed it would save them from misery. But Venezuela claimed to know how to save them without even speaking to them. And after the referendum, Venezuela also made it clear that it was the only state capable between itself and Guyana of properly exploiting the Essequibo. And so my use of the term chauvinism recognizes that Venezuela chose to put its own security and material interests over those of Guyanese and Essequibo, while simultaneously claiming that Guyanese lacked the wherewithal to confront problems internal to Guyana. And so Venezuela chose to ignore Guyanese struggles against Exxon and the Guyanese government versus standing in solidarity with Guyanese people. And thus, as is typical of chauvinism, a narrow type of nationalism started to become popularized in this past month, making solidarity building between Venezuelans and Guyanese harder. And that's because those who accept the chauvinist premise believe that they are in the best position to tell others how to engage and struggle. And if not done the chauvinist way, it's illegitimate. And in the past few weeks, many people have already been exposed to the type of narrow nationalist discourse resulting from Venezuela's chauvinism, namely that Guyana is not or should not be a real country, or Guyanese opposed to Venezuela's referendum are imperialists who oppose socialism. And thus, it's sort of intentionally a type of ahistorical and demeaning discourse towards Guyana and about Guyanese, with the overall goal of ignoring Guyanese struggle writ large historically and in the present.
Okay, thank you for that breakdown, actually, get the different terminologies and meanings. Now, onto a little more like regional view. What role do you see the Organization of American States or the OAS playing in like resolving this dispute?
Well, first of all, I would say that the OAS is not the organization to resolve disputes. The OAS is a tool of Western imperialism in the region. And in fact, from all information released since Ali and Maduro met on Thursday, December 14, it is a good thing that the OAS did not get involved, as apparently prior to the meeting on Thursday, the OAS had a resolution which would have inflamed tensions, according to St. Vincent and the Grenadines Prime Minister Gonzalez. And others, himself and others, had had to ensure that the OAS resolution was not put out prior to the meeting precisely because they said it would inflame tensions. And again, given that the OAS often serves as a US and Canadian mouthpiece in the region, it is not surprising that the OAS seemed to take from Richardson and Southcom's playbook when tensions involved Venezuela. And I do hope that whatever the resolution that was put together at the OAS that was set to come out this week never actually sees the light of day. And this is because if the December 7th statement put out by the OAS is any indication of what its stance would have been, it might have advocated for direct military intervention in the region. And I say this because on December 7th, the OAS basically said Maduro was being aggressive and has escalated conflict in the region, where now there was a legitimate concern for regional security and safety. And they claimed that Maduro was violating international law with the referendum, which even goes against the ICJ, pointing out that the referendum was within the sovereign right of Venezuela, and doing it undemocratically, again, ignoring that the referendum was something that was democratically voted on. And so the OAS statement on December 7th claimed that Maduro not only posed a threat to Guyana, but to the wider Latin American and Caribbean region. And thus the OAS endorsed, and I quote, discussing possible measures to mitigate the crisis. And so from what the OAS put out on December 7th, the situation was already, to them, a crisis level situation requiring immediate addressing. And telling to me is that once the meeting between Ali and Maduro was confirmed for Thursday, December 14th, and that it would include Latin American and Caribbean states with the UN representatives in attendance so that actual diplomacy could happen, the OAS wanted to put out its resolution ahead of the meeting. And Gonzalez again stated that this resolution would have only inflamed tensions, and they had to actually engage in lobbying to wait until after the meeting happened to for the OAS to put out any statement, given that obviously leaders in Latin America and the Caribbean viewed both Ali and Maduro as mature and as not wanting conflict. And so I think the OAS would have actually, made conflict more likely if it put out something or if it took a stance, than not. So I'm glad that the meeting happened between Ali and Maduro and that the OAS didn't put out any resolution.
Okay, thank you for that. Before I touch on St. Vincent and the whole thing that happened on December 14th, in doing research, there are different groups or indigenous people that live in Essequibo. Now, without like during all this or over all this period, have any of these indigenous people been consulted or have they had a position on these disputes?
Okay, so to my understanding so far, there's been a few Amerindian peoples that have gone to the UN to denounce Venezuela's referendum and the potential negative impacts on the Essequibo if Venezuela opts to drastically change relations there through annexation. And again, Venezuela positioned itself as knowing how best to develop the area, and Amerindian peoples in Essequibo do tend to have more autonomy as it currently is with Guyana. There have also been recognized indigenous groups in Essequibo taking similar positions. And this is not surprising given that during Guyana's independence, even though Bernheim claimed to be a socialist and had this power sharing agreement with the United Forest Party, Bernheim's proclamation that he was a socialist made it so that one of the things that his socialism, quote unquote, did do was that of states in South America and the Caribbean, Guyana has some of the most progressive laws as it regards indigenous groups. And I know indigenous groups versus only Amerindians, given that Guyana recognizes Amerindians and Maroon communities as well. Again, live in Essequibo. And so it is also the case that over the past about 6 years, indigenous groups in Guyana have become more political or involved in politics, which has also changed the landscape of politics in Guyana in general, given their increasing impact on the politics of the country as it regards land. And in the next election, you'll see environmental issues being even more so of a concern with ExxonMobil and especially in the Essequibo. But as it regards the indigenous groups outside of the ones who, you know, maybe made statements at the UN, it is also the case that some indigenous groups in Guyana don't speak or know English or Spanish. And so there were concerns shared by some indigenous elders that increasing military activity in the Essequibo without proper or any information being relayed to these communities were causing concerns. I think people in Essequibo were not as tuned in as to what was really happening, given that over 90% of Guyanese in Guyana live on the coast. But in the more interior parts of the country, in the Essequibo, you have sizable Amerindian, indigenous, and Black communities. And when information did reach our interior communities, it was more so the Essequibo is a part of Guyana, and that maybe this was being contested by Venezuela using force. And so I even had family members and friends asking me how serious was it and how likely was it that Venezuela would come in to take over. And these are people living in Guyana asking me this because politicians were visiting the area, news reports and broadcasts were coming out to reaffirm Guyana's borders. And to them, this made it seem like an aggressive attempt by Venezuela was imminent. So many of the official statements put out by indigenous groups in Guyana, if you've seen some of them, denounced Venezuela using force and exclaiming that if Venezuela did use force, Guyana and themselves would use force by any means necessary. And even in these statements, it's unsure if they knew that this could potentially mean getting the U.S. involved, which I'm sure they would certainly reject, given Essequibo and interior politics in Guyana in general have historically been and are at present against Western imperialisms and interventions, which they feel, like my mom and family, prohibited Guyana from developing in the 1970s to today. And so I think in the interior Amerindian and indigenous communities, a lot of them felt as if threat of force was imminent because information wasn't being properly relayed to them.
Could you provide a rundown of the recent talks held in St. Vincent, led by Prime Minister Ralph Gonsalves, regarding the Venezuela-Guyana border situation? A brief overview of what it all ended with, which was like the Declaration of Argyle, if I pronounced that correctly.
Yes, and so the talks that happened on Thursday, December 14, established what is now known as the Joint Declaration of Argyle for Dialogue and Peace. And the name is because the talks between the two held place in Argyle, St. Vincent, and the Grenadines. And important in that declaration is that it says Guyana and Venezuela, directly or indirectly, will not threaten or use force against one another in any circumstances, including those consequential to any existing controversies between the two states. It also reaffirms both states' stances and that Guyana prefers the ICJ and Venezuela prefers another avenue for settling its claims regarding its shared border with Guyana. And so the dialogue itself was not to end or propose solutions for ending Venezuela's claim on Essequibo. The main goal was to ease tensions given the kinds of war and invasion and intervention rhetoric that was floating around. In my view, this meeting had to happen, and how it happened regarding the actors who put it together was essential at helping both Guyana and Venezuela save face while also not getting directly involved in conflict egged on by external actors. You have some people who are now saying that Maduro only agreed to the talks because Brazil had troops at the border. Guyana would get U.S. backing and none of his allies would agree with any direct use of force to end that territory. And then you have some people say Guyana is stupid for even engaging in talks because Venezuela posed some outsized threat to Guyana and the region. But at the end of the day, the talks were successfully able to prevent direct U.S. and Western imperialist intervention in the region, which is an overall good for the entire region, in my opinion. I also think people outside of Guyana and especially outside of Essequibo have this grand fantasy of the U.S. coming in to help, but as is properly phrased, the U.S. ain't want help nobody, it's in it for itself. So we're asked to external audiences, Ali is interpreted as weak for engaging with Maduro while having a misleading upper hand. In Guyana, dialogue worked to his benefit because conflict and direct U.S. intervention in the region would have been highly unpopular. And this is why prior to the talks, Ali contradicted what his vice president said, what his vice president Jagdeo said earlier about a U.S. base in Guyana, noting that Guyana would never threaten anyone with force or use of force, even as it remains unwavering and resolute regarding Guyana's borders. Maduro also noted at the end of Thursday's dialogue that he thanks CELAC and CARICOM for allowing dialogue between himself and Ali. And he also affirmed that the declaration is a great historic step to return to the path of legality, dialogue, and peace. And so some people are misled in that they think that this meeting settled any sort of claim or dispute. But this meeting was basically a way to bring the two leaders to the table to say, despite all of the noise that we are currently hearing, saying that we're close to war or we're close to intervention or this person is inviting this military in, none of that is true because we are committed to a peaceful region, being a zone of peace, and to handling things diplomatically. And so this was a great diplomatic success. In that both states are now agreeing that even though we have our differences on how this border claim by Venezuela should be settled, one thing that we do not differ on is the fact that neither of us and neither of our countries want us to ever reach a period where we're engaged in direct conflict with each other or where we're inviting others to engage in direct conflict, because historically that has not been the way that we've settled tensions between ourselves, and we should not again, settle tensions between ourselves with force. And so a large part of the steps in the declaration is, again, just reaffirming that Venezuela and Guyana have these different stances. Two, neither of them will use force or consent to having an external party use force against the other, regardless of any disputes they may have. And that three, there is now a mechanism in place for them to have dialogue. I think it's as often as every 3 or 4 months, so that they continue to be talking about this issue in a way where it doesn't reach a point where it is today that people are talking about potential war or invasion or intervention.
Yeah, I very much agree with you. It was a great day for diplomacy all around. I think I also like submit to our previous guest, Dr. Braber Wagner, who said whenever there's war, it's a failure of diplomacy. I think, yeah, it was a great day for diplomacy. But still, though, the situation is not resolved. So how would you propose resolving the situation? Do you foresee a resolution emerging from the committed talks under the new declaration?
Personally, I believe that the situation should be deaded. And to me, the surefire way to dead Venezuela's claim, which I do believe is ludicrous, is via the courts or some type of judicial settlement. I'm also aware that Venezuela would reject any sort of judicial settlement, since legally annexation of Essequibo would not be in Venezuela's favor. There's also the diplomatic route, which both Guyana and Venezuela have engaged. Previously in the late 60s, Venezuela did engage in the diplomatic route in bad faith. And so that is why currently Guyana is more dead set on the ICJ settling the dispute. Outside of legal means, there is no real way to settle Venezuela's claim, since it's a tool that Venezuela can weaponize when it chooses to do so, to involve itself in Guyana's politics or rally nationalism within its own country. Initially, when this claim was first weaponized, it was done so that Guyana would not succumb to communist leadership upon independence. And today it is being done because Guyana has thus far aligned itself with Western imperialism and corporations that have been hostile to Venezuela ever since the 1990s, when Chavez was democratically elected and changed the course of Venezuelan politics from being aligned with Western imperialisms and corporations. I personally opt for the judicial settlement as the best way to settle the conflict, given that I do not foresee Guyana compromising any of its territory after having successfully fought colonialism for independence with its borders intact. And I think the best time where Guyana would have been willing for some sort of compromises was after the 1966 and into the early 1970s diplomatic agreement that they had in Geneva with Venezuela. But since Venezuela did not fully engage with Geneva outside of its present misinterpretations of it, that did not happen. From Guyana's perspective, the Geneva Agreement set certain boundaries, and those were: one, that the only discussion after the Geneva Agreement would be about Venezuela's contention that the 1899 Arbitral Award under the Treaty of Washington was null and void. And it is Venezuela's current position that it does not have to prove the nullity of the 1899 decision. Two, from the Guyana perspective, the forum for discussion would be a four-year mixed commission between Guyana and Venezuela. And if that failed to find such an agreement, another machinery that the parties agree upon would have to be chosen. But the four-year mixed commission failed because at that time, the president of Venezuela was afraid that if they engaged in dialogue in the mixed commission, it would liquidate Venezuela's claim in the eyes of other nations, since Venezuela didn't really have any sort of legal claim and couldn't really prove that 1899 was null. And three, failing such an agreement, in the Geneva Agreement about the nullity of the 1899 award, that meant that the dispute would have to be settled by a means chosen by the United Nations Secretary General from processes contained in Article 33 of the UN Charter, ending with judicial settlement. And so really the first two options in the Geneva Agreement have been exhausted. Venezuela cannot prove that the 1899 arbitral award is null and void. Two, Venezuela failed to actively engage in the four-year mixed commission because it didn't want to liquidate its claims on Essequibo. And now three, that technically means you have to rely on judicial settlement. But again, Venezuela knows that judicial settlement will not go in its favor, or that it's unlikely to go in its favor. And so the Geneva Agreement was regarded as the only available option of resolving peacefully the conflict of Venezuela's outrageous claims. But even as the mixed commission was meeting in October 1966, because Venezuela also knew that the Geneva Agreement would not vote in its favor, that's why you had Venezuela violating the agreement by seizing the eastern half of Ancoco Island that Guyana owned, where it has remained in occupation ever since. And even during the Protocol of Port of Spain, where the issue were to lay dormant for 12 years regarding the Essequibo, prior to violating it and ending it in 11 years, Venezuela made certain transgressions in Guyana by putting military in Guyana or military in the borders, and simply used the fact that the Geneva Agreement existed at all to basically say, well, since this agreement exists, that means that the territory is in dispute. And today you still see that being Venezuela's stance. Let's go back to the Geneva Agreement. But again, the Geneva Agreement doesn't work in Venezuela's favor. All it allows Venezuela to do is say, aha, because the Geneva Agreement exists, that means that this territory is in dispute. But again, Venezuela is not looking for a solution because the solution wouldn't work in its favor. And so to me, that's why you would just have to force through judicial settlement so it could be deaded.
Okay. All in all, personally, you can disagree openly if you would like, but I don't see it being deaded at all. Because as you said before, it's a political tool within Venezuela, both from the leftist side and the right wing, to like stir up some nationalism amongst its populations. But I could see some sort of like joint governance situation where I think one of the major things that Maduro was pushing now is the thing about national security, seeing that Exxon was kicked outside of Venezuela. I don't know, Exxon is talking or in talks with Guyana, and then more than likely would be the ones drilling within the Essequibo region. So I think some kind of talks about who will be able to or who should is a good way to like silence the issue, if that makes sense. Am I far off? Too far fetched?
Well, joint governance would not work. Like, I've seen some people saying joint governance and socialism for the Essequibo, but joint governance won't work because, one, first, flat out, Guyana is going to reject it since the Essequibo comprises two-thirds of Guyana's territory, and so then it would be consenting to two-thirds of governance in its territory. But also, two, joint governance wouldn't work or bode well for Venezuela unless more Venezuelans move into Essequibo, precisely because most of the people who would be voting or deciding on anything in a joint governance agreement would be people in Essequibo who identify as Guyanese predominantly. And so people in Essequibo already view the history of Venezuela's transgressions as Venezuela not caring about what people in Essequibo think. Okay. And so how historically and in the present these tensions play out, joint governance would be highly unpopular. And then even me, I could see claims of, oh, Venezuela's settlers coming into Essequibo then becoming a thing, because you would need more Venezuelans in Essequibo for joint governance to work, just based on numbers and who identifies as what.
Yeah.
And so if joint governance were to be a possibility, I think it should have been more forcefully pushed or discussed under Chavez. Mm-hmm. But I think that Maduro at this point has sort of soured the minds of some people in Guyana, that I don't see it even being popular amongst people in the Essequibo. Even initially when he made the overtures in the referendum and he said that the Guyanese people are in misery and Exxon captured the government, you had people in Guyana who've been protesting oil saying, where was he to extend solidarity when we was protesting oil? But now he's coming in saying he owns the territory. Okay. And so, and this is why I pointed out that the chauvinism was not the way to go. Because what is the opposite of chauvinism? Internationalism and solidarity. I think that if joint governance were to work, Maduro would have had to position himself as extending solidarity to the Guyanese people versus being chauvinistic towards the Guyanese people.
Gotcha. Fair point. Well, there you have it. Thank you so much for chatting with us, Dr. John.
Thank you so much for having me.
And to our listeners, remember to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at tenementyard_. And if you're looking for a good read, head to our website at www.tenementyardmedia.com. And don't forget to check out our historical podcast, Lest We Forget. Thanks again for listening.